Veterans Division Committee come to order. And Hudson Davis, would you lead us in the pledge?
Yes.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the minutes. The minutes have been moved. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? I'd like to welcome everybody that's here in the people in the room here, and we're going to change our schedule a little bit. We're going to start with Reps and Cresha has a bill up, and Camp Ripley nearby, the lands of designated centennial landscape. Reps and Cresha. Good afternoon, Reps and Cresha. Welcome to our committee. If you would just introduce yourself for the record.
And thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Representative Cresha from 9B, and I've also asked Representative Jerry Newton to come up as well as a co-sponsor of the bill.
And well, I also have welcome to the committee, and maybe to get this things going, I move that House File 283 be referred to Committee on State Government Finance.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I also have with me on this bill is Don Kerr, as well as Todd Holmgren from the Nature Conservancy. And there isn't a whole lot to this bill. I'll cover it quickly, and then I'll ask the testifiers to speak on the bill, if that's okay.
That's fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So what we have here, Camp Ripley spans 53,000 acres up in my area. And one of the things that happens is we shoot a lot of big guns off. And those big guns cause lots of noise. And with the expansion of Camp Ripley and the fantastic job they're doing, they don't see a lessening of military actions and mission. In fact, they see an increase. And so what we're trying to do is work with the landowners around the area of Camp Ripley. We have an ACUP program, but we're also expanding out in what we call the Sentinel Landscape. And this is the idea behind this is a willful participation for landowners. They can put their acreage into this program, and it will allow them to get a designation of Sentinel Landscape, which then allows our members on this committee to go out and look for federal funds and ways to try and reimburse those members. The idea is if they're going to give up some easements and hold back on some development, then we're going to try to get them some help and some relief with property tax. Because what we're trying to avoid is, as we're doing mission and we're doing military activities, we don't want to get down the road where somebody would put up a townhome or a large apartment building, and then they come back and say, oh, geez, we didn't realize it was going to be this loud or that you were going to be shooting guns this close to us. So we're trying to avoid those conversations and making this, again, a willful participation. The other thing is, around our area, conservation is very, very important. We have a wonderful deer population, and we have lots of hunting and lots of activities, and many of these landowners have said, we would like to put our land into a conservation program that we know it will stay that way and we'll be able to support conservation down the road. So that's what we're asking for with this. It's simply a designation, and property owners could seek the designation, they could get that designation, and they could participate in this down the road. So that's from my testimony, that's what I have to offer, and Representative Newton, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Representative Cresha. For the record, Jerry Newton, House District 37A. I mentioned to Representative Cresha that I grew up in South Minneapolis in the 1940s, and I remember at the Walt Chamberlain Airfield, it used to be the Naval Air Station, was quite a ways away from the city at the time. And with the encroachment of housing right after World War II, there were buildings going up closer and closer to the airport, which is now the Minneapolis airport. But in the late 40s, early 50s, there was a terrible accident there. And I'm just pointing that out that, you know, it was a military plane that went down, crashed into a few homes, and killed quite a few people. So that's the one problem you have. The additional problem is as the airport expanded, the military's operation became smaller. But the Metropolitan Airports Commission has had to pay a tremendous amount of money on soundproofing homes because we've got more and more planes coming in, louder planes. And that's what I think we're going to run into out here is as well with the advent of new weapon systems, new training systems. This area, if there's housing that's close to the area, would in years to come demand either soundproofing or some other form of changes to the way that we do things at the fort. So I just wanted to bring that up as in support of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Newton. And it's just a quick story myself. You know, I've done a lot of training up at Camp Ripley over the years, and I remember we're out at set up my shelter half. For those that have been in the military years back, know what a shelter half is. And I'm getting ready to bed down for the evening, and all of a sudden, boom! And I got up, I went over a little knoll, and they had the big gun firing off. So all night, so it just shakes the whole ground. So I know what we're trying to do with the land adjacent to Camp Ripley there. So. Any other? We have a question, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to all the testifiers, I would also support what you're talking about. Slightly different scenarios, but with the same kind of impact. My husband grew up in Manhattan, Kansas, which is, I think, about 15 miles from Fort Riley, one of the largest military establishments in that area, and. I lived there for 4 years in Manhattan. Big guns going off all the time. And that's not changing. And as armature gets more powerful, it just also gets louder. And then you have the potential consequence of neighboring facilities being impacted by airplanes as well as armaments that can go not necessarily where they're supposed to. Also, in my district, I have police and the public safety facilities using a firing range that was purchased and established about 35 years ago. And no one paid attention to the fact that the city was allowing them to build houses all around this firing range. There are now over 30-some public safety divisions that use that, so it's almost around the clock. They do stop at night, at least in the summertime, but people are having trouble, a lot of trouble. Houses should never have been built there, or we're looking at alternatives for firing ranges now and places where we can build new ones at much greater expense and underground facilities, but it is impacting people all around there and the wildlife. People are concerned about the environmental impact of the remnants of these firings. So I really support your being thoughtful and looking ahead to make sure that we have the opportunity to have the military preparations in place, and also public safety. Thanks.
Representative Luke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This certainly makes sense, and as Representative Kreisha is fully aware, district I represent borders. We're just across the river from Camp Ripley, and I'm a good many miles from Camp Ripley, and I do hear those guns. So it's very important, and my wife and I raised a couple little ones while we were living at a place called the Naval Weapons Ordnance Station at Dahlgren, Virginia. And that was at a time when we were bringing back the battleships and the 16-inch guns. And so I'm quite familiar with the issues for sound and the disruption that can cause. So we need to make sure that we do everything we can to prevent those kind of conflicts in the future. So I certainly support Representative Cresha's efforts here.
And Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is with regard to the terminology, which I hadn't ever heard of before, sentinel landscapes. And I'm wondering if this is specified in statute, and if so, what are the parameters? What does our statute say about sentinel landscapes?
Representative Cresha. And thank you for the question, Representative Pugin. I'm going to just touch on all three of yours real quickly, and then I'm going to turn over to Don Kerr to address that. Representative Ward, first of all, you're absolutely right. And one of the reasons, and this will probably tie into what you have as well, Representative Pugin, but part of what we're trying to do with the Sentinel designation is we're tying in agencies. And this will allow us to work with agriculture, DNR, and a number of other ones so that we can expand our mission beyond just the military scope, as well as to other conservation efforts. And just quickly to what you said, Representative Lewick, part of the good that comes out of this is when we shoot the big guns, these deers are getting used to loud sounds, so they don't hear me sneak up on them anymore, because I'm not a very good hunter. But you're absolutely right. This does come to what we're doing with conservation efforts. Now, as far as the definition, Representative Pugh, I'm going to have Don Kerr address that so I make sure I get that right.
Mr. Kerr, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs. And Representative Pugh, to your question, I'm glad you asked it. So we already do a lot in this area through a DOD program in the Department of the Army called the Army Compatible Use Buffer Program. And largely through what Minnesota has done, the challenge with the program is it's not one of the high-profile programs within the Department of Defense and therefore is chronically underfunded. So there's never enough money in the Department of Defense specifically to carry out the conservation efforts that we, just at Camp Ripley, would like to continue to pursue. The Department of Defense looked at what we do in Minnesota by using, working with our partners in the Board of Water and Soil Resources, the Nature Conservancy, Morrison County, to find other methods of preserving this land in use that's compatible to our military use at Camp Ripley. And we do get some funding through the Lasard Sands Outdoor Heritage Fund, or at least have in the past, and expect that to continue. And when DOD looked at that, they started looking around and saying, you know, we have unused resources within the federal government, but because they're in other agencies, we're not looking at how we can make them work well together. For example, there are programs within the Department of Agriculture that are very similar to what we do through the ACUB program. There are programs within the Department of Interior that are very similar, and what the Sentinel Landscapes concept at the federal level will do is allow us to look more broadly beyond just the Department of Defense. And by having the state of Minnesota pass the Sentinel Landscapes law, establishing us as a Sentinel Landscapes state, we will have a competitive advantage at the federal level competing for funds from outside the Department of Defense and inside the Department of Defense to allow us to move what we currently have as a 30-year plan for our ACUP program at Camp Ripley more rapidly by using additional funding sources. And that's where the specific language comes from, Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Kerr, and Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Kerr. I really appreciate that that response, which generated another question. Is this bill designating sentinel landscapes, is it setting it in statute, or is it already in statute and this would fall underneath sentinel landscapes?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Pugh, so what this does is it establishes the board in a process inside the state of Minnesota, led by the Adjutant General, but also with participation from the commissioners of other state agencies that have like interests, to determine what the Sentinel Landscape should be. Sentinel Landscape itself is tied currently to a DOD program, but it does not currently exist in statute in Minnesota. This would establish that board that would then have the authority to designate the Sentinel Landscape.
Okay. If there are any other comments, any comments from Vice Chair Hancock?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was stationed at Fort Sill, Oklahoma for 2 years, so I'm familiar with loud noises. Just a question on the language here. It says the coordinating committee shall, in line 1-14, coordinating committee shall include all working in natural lands wherever located that the coordinating committee believes contribute to the long-term sustainability of military missions conducted at Camp Ripley. And Representative Kreshaw, I know you mentioned willful participation. What are the implications towards unwillful participation?
Reverend Kreshaw?
Thank you for that, Representative Hancock, and thank you, Mr. Chair. Which line was that again? Was that, did you say 1.4 or 2.4?
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kreshaw, it would be 1.14. It starts with, towards the end of the language there, it says, the coordinating committee shall include all working in natural lands. In other words, we're designating the lands. And I'm just wondering, you know, and we're talking also, it says later on about the willful participation of landowners. And I'm just wondering if I own land in this designated Sentinel area and really did not care to put it into a conservation or that type of thing, what are the implications of the bill?
Representative Kreshaw.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. So, great question. So, in the first section that you call out, 1.14, that just designates the land. So, all we're doing is we're drawing a map of what acreages will be eligible for this. And then we had extensive conversations on the second part, 2.3 to 2.5, in making sure that while you may be within that perimeter, this is completely voluntary. So, what happens if you don't want to participate? Nothing. You pay your taxes. You can do whatever you want with your land. If you want to put up townhomes, you want to put up easements, however you want, you go right ahead. What we're trying to avoid is the eminent domain situation, and I want to be very careful to say that. We're making sure that we never have to get into that situation where, because of military operations, expansion, and so forth, that we would have to come in. Quite honestly, right now, we have more landowners that are trying to volunteer than we do have property. So we've had no problem with that right now. If you, as a landowner, do not want to participate, you just simply don't participate. But you have to understand where you live and the proximity that you are to the big guns and the loud noises.
Okay. Representative Hancock. Representative Leach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kreshaw, is... Well, I guess maybe Mr. Kerr might be able to answer this better. But when Representative Kreshaw spoke of eminent domain, have there been instances of eminent domain used by the Department of Military Affairs leading up to this point? Like, how many, how frequently does that happen?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Kerr?
Representative Lesh, the Adjutant General does in statute now have the authority of eminent domain to expand Camp Ripley should that ever become militarily necessary. That authority has not been used at least since the 50s, and I believe it was earlier than that. I believe that Camp Ripley was established near its total end state in the 30s, but I can check and get back to you on the actual dates. There is no... First of all, within this statute, this would not change the Adjutant General's authority with regard to eminent domain in any way. This is a willing landowner program. But I can assure you there is no intention at this point or anywhere in the future that our staff sees today of a requirement to increase the size of Camp Ripley through the use of eminent domain.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Leach.
Thank you for that answer, Mr. Croy. I trust you that it doesn't change eminent domain. Those of us around here that remember the last fight of eminent domain probably don't want to reprise that whatsoever. But in relation to what this does do, I apologize I came a little late, Mr. Chair, but I'm wondering, the only, I guess, parallel I can think of in my head is all of the South Minneapolis situation where the folks move in next to an airport and then they're getting money to update their windows and whatnot. what's in it for these adjacent homeowners? Is it going to be that same kind of thing, Mr. Kerr? I mean, to insulate their windows, or what other? How do you anticipate that this is used for the participation, if we participate?
Mr. Kerr or Representative Cresha?
Thank you. And if I could, thank you, Mr. Chair, and if I could, Representative Blesch. So the program is to avoid those scenarios. The program is to avoid the easements and putting in structures that would be too close to proximity to cause those problems. We have a $330 million operation up there that brings a lot of economic development, and most of the landowners, if not all, understand the value of what we have. So what we're trying to do is preserve their wishes of putting their property into conservation, and in exchange for those easements, we're looking for sentinel landscape designations so we can go out and find additional federal funds, and part of it would be to offset some of their property taxes. So in exchange for you putting this easement in, we're going to try to find a property tax relief to you. We use the ACUB, but some of that money is running out. So what the trade-off is if you put your program in here, we'll go out, the Sentinel Landscape Committee will go out and try to find dollars to offset that or to expand conservation efforts and other things, to use that land for other things other than putting up townhomes or something else that might cause problems with the windows and so forth, if that helps.
That helps. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Any other questions? Okay. I renew my motion to... I'm sorry. Public testimony? Any public testimony? Okay. With that, then I renew my motion to refer House File 283 to State Government Finance. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Representative Cresha.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Okay. Next thing on the agenda, we're going to go to item number 7. With the Assistant Counsel for Veterans Adjournment, or excuse me, Minnesota Assistant Counsel for Veterans, and we have Mrs. Kathleen Vitalis. And for those of the public, our next item will be House File 134, followed by House File 137.
Thank you so very much.
Well, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Kathleen Vitalis, the CEO of Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans. And I'll just be speaking. You won't see my slideshow, but that's all right. I know how to do that as well. And I'm here to just give an update on our grant that we get, and I'll go through some of the highlights. I did give you a one-page summary,
okay.
And I think what I'll do is just use that as my basis for going through where we are at today, and then answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, thank you.
So the first thing is that MACV is a 501c3 nonprofit. We are in our 25th year of serving veterans, homeless and in crisis veterans around the state. My slideshow might help me as I go through this. We do that through three regional offices that are located in the Metro, in Duluth, and Mankato. But I want to be absolutely specific. We served veterans last year in all 87 counties. So we do that with our outreach staff through those main locations. We are certified by the Minnesota Charities Review Council and the Better Business Bureau. And we are audited annually by Clifton Larson Allen. We have a major audit, and we also have many funder audits throughout the year. The update that I will bring, and some of you may be new to MACV, so please, I will take any questions as well. But basically, last year, we assisted 1,800 veterans and their families with direct services, and again, in all 87 counties. We had over 25,000 contacts through our offices and staff, and I have 30 full-time staff, so that's a lot of phone calls coming in. We also provide some of our own housing at MACV. So what I just said, of course, is that we use all of our grants and funding for the 1,800 families, but we have 77 beds of our own housing that we have developed and provide as a foundational base. We have 11 units of permanent supportive housing in Mankato for formerly homeless and disabled veterans. That's been operating since 2006. We have 11 units of permanent supportive housing in Duluth for formerly homeless and disabled veterans, and that opened 3 years ago. We also have transitional housing in scattered site, meaning we own and operate homes, residential homes, 10 homes in South Minneapolis, Richfield, St. Cloud, a woman veterans home in St. Paul, and Duluth. We have one in Maplewood. So that's up to 2 years, and it's transitional housing for veterans. We provide assistance in three major areas. So all of the grants and funding that we get have something to do with either employment, housing, or legal assistance. Those are our three main areas. We also provide, through the housing grants, things like rental assistance, utility assistance, food vouchers, transportation, and then our vet law program. We are very proud of that. That actually started a few years ago, but what we're able to do with that is that we had 34 legal clinics, one-day clinics, throughout the state in different locations in 2014. All veterans welcome. And we were able to assist over 1,300 veterans through those legal clinics. And that is also due to our network of pro bono attorneys and relationships that we maintain. We hosted 8 stand-down events in 2014. These are major events. A stand-down is, the first stand-down was in San Diego many years ago. And a stand-down is where you bring providers of services together in the metro. Our main event is in August. It's actually 2 days, and we do it at the Boy Scout Base Camp. We had over 70 providers of services come in, including, of course, the federal VA with medical and mental health, all the way down to people doing haircuts and massages, and we provide lunch. So you try to child support. We have legal people at stand down. It's kind of a one stop for if you have issues that are standing in the way of your stable housing and employment, we try to have service providers there that in those 2 days can take care of those issues rather than you tracing around to a myriad of offices over the course of 1 to 2 months to try to accomplish the same thing. We also have leverage the state grant and funding that we get through the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs represents about 15% of our budget. And it is absolutely a foundational grant that we get because we're able to leverage it with all sorts of other federal sources and funding and foundational and corporate grants. Some of the veteran statistics in 2014 that I thought you might find interesting is that women veterans represent 11% of who we serve. The post 9/11 veterans are 33%. So about a third now of who we serve are post 9/11. Veterans with a disability, 77%. And then the, so we have a third post 9/11, a third Vietnam and Vietnam era, and the other third of the veterans would be everything else, from peacetime to World War II, Korean. And we have our youngest veteran that we have assisted is 18, and our oldest veteran is 95. So we follow the full gamut of services. And again, if they're presenting with an issue that is destabilizing their housing or their employment. The keys to our success are in some major areas that I think are very important. First, we're statewide. Being statewide, we're able to leverage a lot of different resources. Non-duplicated services is extremely important, especially in the veterans arena. We do not duplicate anything done by any of our other partners, such as the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, the Federal VA, or the County Veterans Service Officers. We refer to them for their programs. Partners and collaborators, we have hundreds of volunteers, and we also have many grants, community grants. A grant that we are able to get is V4V, and I know that Dean is here today. So if there is a foundational grant or corporate grant that we can utilize to support what our mission is, we will go after it and try to secure it. And again, we focus on veteran eligibility, accountability, and self-sustainability. So in other words, if someone, and the veterans present themselves, have extremely complicated circumstances, as you can imagine. When someone comes to us and says, I need a job, that's probably not where you start with them. There is a reason that things are going wrong for them. Or I need my rent paid. The question has to be why. And when you ask why, you uncover the core issues, perhaps legal issues, that you can address. So that our one time or perhaps 1 or 2 months of assistance truly gets them stabilized and they become self-sustaining once again. We are not a long-term subsidy program of any kind. And then I always talked about the leveraged sources of funding that we are able to use and bridging the gap. In my presentation, it shows all of the different services for veterans, and the way that I like to look at MACV and our staff is that we take those gaps in services and we bridge that gap, and so that the veterans in this state have all sorts of services that they can obtain so that they can become truly self-sustaining. And that's a brief overview. The pictures were much better than me speaking. But I also wanted to mention, and then of course if you have any questions, Twin Cities Public TV issued a grant, obtained a grant last year, and they chose MACV to do a half-hour documentary called Crossing the Threshold. And you can see this via our website, which is on your handout. It's on the front page. It takes about 20 to 25 minutes to watch, but I highly recommend it if you're trying to find out a little bit more about what we do. There are staff members in this video that used to be our clients, and they tell their story in their words. Chairman Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Vitalis. I know you mentioned the showdowns.
Stand-downs,
sir. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I try not to do showdowns, but
yeah,
yes.
The stand-downs, okay. How many have been to a stand-down on the committee? I've been to a couple of them now, and if you could maybe send out the dates that and locations of your stand-downs to not only this committee but state government finance, that would be great. It would be nice to have legislators come in and just see what's going on at these events and the service that you provide towards our veterans and our men and women in uniform. So I'd really appreciate that. Any other questions? Yes. Who is it over here? Hancock, was that a question? Fisher, I'm sorry, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is before I testify, Ms. Vitalis. I'm not real familiar with your total funding and size of budgets and everything. I was just kind of wanting to know a little bit more about your organization. What is the total dollar amount that you raise each year, and what are your different funding sources?
We have a private...
Ms. Vitalis?
Representative and Chairman Detmer. We have this year and coming into 2015 about a $5.5 million operating budget. And our funding sources are, I'll start at the federal level, and just, I'm not going to go through everyone, but the Department of Labor, HVRP Vets, Veteran Employment and Training Service, gives us our big federal employment grant. We have the VA, the federal VA, has a large supportive services for veterans and their family grant. We also get HUD funding for many of our supportive services for our houses and for the Capitol building that we did. And then coming through, of course, our state grant that we get through the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs and the legislature. And then I would say it's a compilation after that of about over 75 to 100 foundations and corporations, to name a few: the Otto Bremer Foundation, V4V, as I've already mentioned, the St. Paul Foundation. So we also have a lot of regional foundations, such as Blandin, for those of you that are up in the north. So what I'm able to do with the statewide mission is get some of those regional foundations and then direct the money to that region. So, and our balance sheet with our assets is about $8 million.
Representative Fisher? Okay. Representative Pugh?
Yes, thank you. You know, just a point of clarification about the funding. So the amount that you receive within Minnesota from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs is how much?
$750,000 a year, 1.5 on the biennium.
Okay, thank you. And then my other question was really little. I'm really struggling with all of the acronyms.
Yes.
And you mentioned that 33% of the veterans in Minnesota are post 9/11 veterans. Is that correct? Did I get that correct?
Yes, Representative, that is correct.
Okay, thank you. And yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll try to stay on top of things, too.
So. And so the acronyms that I am looking at your sheet under Veterans Serve Since 2014, and I see OIF/OEF, and I don't know what that stands for.
Ms. Vitalis?
Chairman and Representative, I'll add another one on there, OND, and now I'll talk about all three. It's Operation Iraqi Freedom, Operation Enduring Freedom, Operation New Dawn.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions from the committee? Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The next agenda item will be House File 134, and I'll be presenting that, and we'll have a change of the guard here.
Thank you, and Representative Detmer, would you care to move your bill?
Yes, I, Mr. Chair and committee members, like to move House File 134 and refer it to the General Register.
Very good. Representative Detmer, through your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. The bill, basically, it's a kind of a housekeeping bill. The bill sets in process by removing a trustee from an irrevocable trust established from the proceeds of a sale of Big Island's veterans camp, and repeals the section of statute concerning now a defunct board of the governors of the Big Island veterans camp. So there's no fiscal impact that we expect, but I have some testifiers here, and if they would introduce themselves, then we can go on.
Very good. And would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Dean Ashman. I'm a member of the Veterans for Veterans Trust Fund. I'd like to also introduce Marlon Ronning. Marlon is also a member of the Board of Trustees of their B4B.
Very
First
good.
Of all, I'd like to, Mr. Chair.
By all means, go ahead, sir.
give you some brief history of how the Minnesota Veterans for Veterans Trust Fund actually came about. In 1923, Big Island became a Big Island veterans camp after previous owners had gone into debt, and an amusement park that was there was dismantled. In the early 1980s, the state of Minnesota took control of the island after it had become into came into disrepair, and after a few years put the island under a board of governors, a nonprofit organization, and a statute 197, 131, 132, and 133 were put in place. And to ensure diversity in the council, or in the board of governors at that time, the statute stated that two representatives from the American Legion, the VFW, Military Order, the Purple Heart, and the Disabled Veterans would all be make up the eight members of this board of governors. And over the years, up until 2004, 2005, the island and the management struggled with the upkeep of the island and the management of the island. In 2004 and 2005, the board of governors voted or made a decision to sell the island. The statute, which is in front of you, actually dictated how that would happen. And the island was sold to the city of Orinal for $5.8 million. And the statute required that if the island was ever sold, that a new board would be established in the same manner, and that the funds would be put into an irrevocable trust. We're happy to say that in 2005, 2006, the organization called Veterans for Veterans Trust Fund was established, and the eight members were appointed by the four organizations. And we have maintained that $5 million, but at the same time have granted over $1.4 million to veterans projects throughout the state of Minnesota. The statute also requires that the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs be an advisor to the committee and have the final approval on all grants. The commissioner has been an active member of active participant in our meetings. We meet once a month. But in the year 2005, the Board of Trustees of Veterans for Veterans Trust Fund developed a trust agreement, a set of bylaws. We put a grant process in place, and we also selected Wells Fargo Wealth Management to manage our portfolio as well as advise us on the grant process and put the grant and actually manage our grant process. Since 2006, we have met monthly, and we have granted, as I said earlier, $1.4 million while still maintaining the original investment. As I said, the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs is an active attendee at our meetings and again approves all grants that we, the board, choose to award. Recently, we revisited our bylaws. We took a look at our trust agreement and also went back and looked at the statute, and that's why we're here today. We'd like to ask for your help in updating the statute. We would like to note that we would like to add to the statute a statement that we and our Wells Fargo consultant feel is very important to ensure that our board of trustees can ensure continuity, if we can maintain the experience and have control over the board makeup. In the previous obsolete portion of the statute, it states that the appointing organizations can at any time remove a member of the board. Now, that was put in there back in the 1980s. We would like to change and add the words, the trustees appointed under paragraph B shall have the exclusive authority to remove a trustee of the trust established under paragraph B. A trustee may be removed at any time without cause upon a majority vote of the trustees with the consent and approval of the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs. And we're simply asking that this be done so we can effectively govern the organization that we are charged to take care of and be obedient to. And without the ability to remove trustees, we're limited in a way that most organizations are not. And be reminded, we still have the oversight of the commissioner. The additional words also limits the board from exposure from external interests that could attempt to have undue influence on the board makeup. In short, we're simply asking us you to help us in allowing us to govern the board like most organizations. And in closing, I'd like to state that we value having the four organizations have the appointing authority over our board. We are all appointed for a two-year term or reappointed for a two-year term by the four organizations that I mentioned earlier, which gives us diversity, organizational diversity, as well as a broad experience across the state of Minnesota. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Ashman. Do we have any questions? Representative Newton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know whether I should address this to Mr. Detmer or Representative Detmer or not, but I'm a little confused here because on lines on line 121 and again on line 24, it indicates that the board is set up and appointed according to the statutes 197-131, but then you're repealing that statute or those statutes in section 2 on lines 214 to 15.
Mr. Ashman or Mr. Representative Detmer?
I think we might need some help here from our research house.
All right. Mr. Chair, members, I believe the reference to Minnesota statutes 2014 is inserted to make it clear to practitioners that they need to go back to this version of the statutes to see the language that was governing the Board of Governors. And so it's not unheard of to have references to past versions of the statute in law, but it's just a way to direct people to go to the appropriate version.
Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To me, it would be a little confusing, I think, to have to go back to something that's been repealed to look at how it's done. And I have no, I think this is a good idea, but I think it would be better to have the portions that are being repealed actually put in the text of the bill. That's my suggestion.
Mr. Chair, in House research, is that something that is done in other pieces of legislation? I'm not sure if that's...
Mr.
Diebel. Mr. Chair, members, I'm not aware of that practice. This is the standard way to manage the statutes. I think it's actually intended to avoid the confusion of having a Board of Governors listed that is no longer in existence. And so it's the intent of the policy is to make the statutes less cluttered with obsolete language and then to remove references to things that would confuse a reader. So I understand where Representative Newton is coming from, but the general intent of the policy, I believe, is to provide clarity, not to confuse people.
Representative Newton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If it works, it works. I would find it confusing to have to refer to something that's been repealed as justification for as to how you set up a board, but if that's how we do it, that's fine.
Okay. Yes, Representative Ward.
Thank you. I apologize. I had to take a phone call, and so I missed some of this. I was just looking at some internet research on the property, and so I'm really confused as to what the intent is here. the most recent research that I'm seeing says the majority of the site was placed on a conservation easement to preserve the open space, its open space and natural character, and it will be only minimally developed to allow for passive recreational and educational uses. So what, where are we going with this?
Representative or Mr. Ashman?
Are you referring to the island itself? Yeah, the island was purchased by the city of Orono for mm-hmm. $5.8 million mm-hmm. and preserved in its natural state. The funds came from the city of Orono, $3 million, $2 million from the legislature, and $0.8 million from the Minnehaha Watershed District. Mm-hmm. And since that time, it's been maintained as a city park, and some of the buildings that were out there for cabins have been dismantled and removed. So it's strictly an Orono city park. And many children's activities go on out there during the summer. It's really no longer our property. We manage the money that was received from that.
Representative Ward.
I'm sorry, I'm still confused as to why it's going through this committee then.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ward, I was approached because the whole thing, if you've read mm-hmm. the piece of legislation here, is that the Board of Governors of the island, the Veterans Camp, what used to be the Veterans Camp, voted in 2013 to disband the camp.
Right.
Thus making the statutes concerning the board establishment powers and duties and obsolete. So they're asking that we do some correction in the statute that allows them to remove a person from the Board of Trustees and replace them in a timely manner. And the bill allows to remove the trustee without cause by a majority vote of the trustees and a consent of the, and it has to be with the consent of the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs. So,
follow up.
You might have missed some things when you're out. Yeah.
Sorry. So essentially, it's the spring house cleaning.
Yes.
Technical stuff.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's house cleaning.
Thank you.
If I could,
Representative Ashman.
Maybe I think the portion you missed was the fact that once the island was sold, the statute said a new board would have to be put in place to manage the funds.
Okay.
We're members of that new board, and so the additional words to the statute pertain to the new board.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Ashman? Representative Detmer?
Yes, thank you, Chair, Mr. Chair, and the board members. Again, I renew my motion to House 134 be referred.
Excuse
to
me, Representative Detmer. Yes. Do we have anyone from the audience for public testimony who would like to testify on the bill? Yes, if you would, sir, please state your name for the record.
Mike McKelley, Legislative Director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And Mr. Chair, all I wanted to say today and to Representative is this is, in our eyes, essentially a housekeeping bill. Last year was the unsession, you may recall, to remove antiquated language out of statute, and that's what we believe this is and what this bill does. So Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs is fully aware of it and in support of it.
Thank you, Mr. McKelley. Any question? Yes, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McElhinney, I may have missed this, but how did this end up on the cutting room floor last year?
Mr. McKelley?
On the, how, Mr.
How,
Chair?
This was part of your, Mr. Chair, Mr. McElhinney, this was part of your agenda last year, but it didn't make it through. So how did it get deleted?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh, it came to us last year late as a recommendation to help reduce statute, and it was just late in the process of where the agencies are in the sequence of events. So it just didn't make the cut last year, if you will.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anything further, Mr. Representative? Representative Detmer.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and committee members. I renew my my motion to refer House File 134 to the General Register.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Oppose? The bill is, the motion is referred to the General Register. We'll now proceed to Chair would like to now bring House File 137 before the committee. Representative Detmer, do you have a motion?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I move that we refer House File 137 to the Great Committee on Taxes.
Okay. Representative Detmer, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. As you, many of you probably know, if you were around last year, I carried basically the same piece of legislation last year, and we actually, on the House floor, we got it amended onto the House floor, and with a 68-55 vote, and but because of a miscue on the delete all amendment, it wasn't part of the delete all amendment put forth, so it did not appear. In the conference committee, but as many of you know, I've been here 8 years. This has been a priority of mine to work on how we tax our veterans' retirement pay, the men and women that serve in our military. And maybe I should explain a little bit about military retirement. I mean, if you haven't been around a military family, first of all, how many here have people in your family or personally have served in the military? Okay. And so you might have some knowledge about how a person, young man and women get a retirement in the military. Number one, you need to have at least 20 years or medically retired. There is a small group of men and women in Minnesota that were forced to retire with 18 years. That was during the Clinton years where they had a drawdown, and they will be covered under this piece of legislation too. But the active component, if you're in the active Army, I know Representative Newton, you served 30 plus years in the active component. You need to have at least 20 years or be medically retired. But a lot of people don't understand about the reserve component or National Guard component. Again, you still need to have 20 years, but you got to have 20 good years. And a good year means that you have to have earned at least 50 points to put forth a good year. And you get so many points for being a member of the National Guard or the reserve, and you get so many points for, you get a point per day of on a weekend, let's call a muta 4 or a muta 5 if you go on a Friday. So you could get up to 5 points on a weekend on drilling, and you get 15 points or so for your annual training. And for any day that you serve and going to schools or so forth, you get points. So the way they figure out your retirement then after 20 years, they take all the points that you've earned. Depending on your rank, you get so many cents per point. Could be 30 cents, 40 cents, 45 cents, or whatever it is per point. And that figures, and they put in a formula and they figure out what your retirement is going to be. Okay? So there's a little background on how you earn there. Because of, and as a reservist or a National Guard, you don't start drawing any retirement until you turn age 60. So as a active component, you can start drawing your retirement right after you retire. But as a reserve component or a National Guard component, you have to reach the age of 60. Because of the force reductions that we've had recently and years past, many times there's men and women that would like to continue serving, but because of the force reductions, they're shown the door. There's the door. Thank you for your service. And if they don't, if the federal government doesn't allow you to have early retirement, you could be leaving the service without any retirement at all. So that's something that we need to be aware of. And when they retire, they're given a list of states that are friendly towards military retirees. And I would like to be able to put Minnesota on that list. As a state, I think we do a lot of things for our veterans. We hear that every day, and people that come and testify in our committees, the things that they're doing. Today we heard about MACD, what they're doing for our men and women that have run about some hard times. We passed some legislation for job preferences when hiring, or preferences when you own a small business as a veteran. We're trying to do things to draw our veterans and keep our veterans in Minnesota, even those that have been here for years as a guard or a reservist. When they turn that age 60, we want to keep them here. They've done a lot of things for our state. They've ran businesses and so forth, and we want to keep them here. But they're given a list of states, as I mentioned, that are friendly towards veterans. I had an interesting talk with Governor Walker from Wisconsin. We had the groundbreaking ceremony back for the bridge of Stillwater. And right away, you know me, I get on the topic of veterans and what Wisconsin is doing and so forth. And he had mentioned to me, and I knew ahead of time before I asked questions, that they don't tax the veterans' retirement pay. And he talks highly about the veterans that stay there in Wisconsin. And then he made a statement to me. He said, Representative Demers, someday maybe I'd like to see Wisconsin just not have income tax. You know, he had that little smirk on his face, and I looked at him, and then I looked at some of the pillars or things where the bridge is going to go. I said, you know, that bridge is going to be pretty busy going from west to east. But we know that if you're going to take away income tax, you're going to have other taxes to make up the difference. We know that, and other states do that too. But House File 137, let me give you just a breakdown. It's similar to the language that I had last year, but the bill makes federal retirement pay and pensions subtractive for income for tax purposes. And any individual who receives a retirement, whether you're medically retired or in some cases with 18 years, the federal government is eligible for subtracting individual or including early out retirements, medically retired, and those receiving survivor benefits. The subtraction is capped. Talking to our research people and the people that are putting together the fiscal or the revenue note, they like the idea that I've capped it at 20 years, or in this case would be $30,000. And it treats all people in the military the same way, whether you're enlisted, non-commissioned officers, or officers, that when you sit down with your tax person, you can subtract a capped off at $30,000. Now, I have no idea what it's going to cost, really. We'll see when we get the fiscal note, but I know for sure that when we see what that is, that I'll be sitting down with our tax chair and see how we can take a look at the bill and how we can make it so it's going to fit into what we want to do in terms of our budget. And I think we should try to do everything we can to put this bill forward and say to our men and women who are serving and are already here serving that this is a place to stay, and this is where we want you to raise your families. And for a lot of you, you probably don't know that when a veteran comes into the state of Minnesota, what do they bring with them? They bring a lot of these federal money into the state of Minnesota. You have your Montgomery GI benefits. Now their spouse and their kids can use this for college. They're bringing their TRICARE, their health benefits, their health insurance benefits with them. They're going to buy homes. They're going to start businesses, vehicles, all these things. I think you people understand that. And this is why I think it's so important that we take this bill, get it over to taxes, and see where we're at after we get the revenue note. And I do have some people here
that would like to testify, and I'll just turn it over to them at this point.
Yes, would you please identify yourself for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, my name is Ralph Donay.
Proceed, Mr. Donay.
Yes, sir. I'm the chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council. I've been lucky enough to work with a great bunch of men and women who support veterans' issues in the state. That's our goal. I just wanted to point out to you, I think all of you got the sheet in your packet that shows how much money the state of Wisconsin has brought into their economy since they went tax-exempt back in 2000. As of 2013, that figure was $390 million went into their state budget. In 2013, that amount of money was over $51 million more than Minnesota. So just figuring that that amount hasn't decreased any, as of 2014, we're talking $440 million plus that has gone into Wisconsin's economy. Now, just other than the money issue alone, do you want people like myself to come back to Minnesota? I came back to Minnesota. I went to St. Cloud State. I got a college degree from St. Cloud State. It's a teaching degree. I taught for a while. I've coached youth sports in the state. I help support St. Andrews Elementary School. I'm on the board of directors for the North Star Boys Choir. Any of you who have ever gone to any of our concerts, you understand that those boys are world-class singers. I'd also like to point out that not everyone that retires is immediately given their retirement pay. Currently, there are over 1,400 reservists or National Guard folks that aren't getting their pay yet because they're not age 60. They don't get that pay until they reach age 60. For myself, my wife and I moved 30 times in 28 years. So you say, why stay in the military? Well, if you've seen, excuse me, I get a little emotional, American Sniper, you understand why people stay in the military and what we do for our country. The military action group here at the Capitol has been going for about 8 years, maybe 9 years. It was set up by Representative Severson, who also happened to be a Navy pilot, was a 20-year-plus veteran. And so the military action group has brought this before the legislature several times in the last 8 or 9 years. And I'm proud to say that I've been able to come every year and give you the best information that I can about this bill, that you can make a good, solid decision of what to do. Do you want these military retirees to come back to Minnesota? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Denain, for your service and your testimony today. Yes, would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Kaiser. I'm the vice chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council, which is as many veteran organizations that support this. I'm a Vietnam combat veteran. I did 3 years and got out. But I've been a veterans advocate for since 2001, when I watched that airplane crash into that tower in New York City. This is an equitable way of doing this. I've been up here as many times as Ralph has, 8 to 10 years. And there's always been a conflict with the members, House and Senate, that officers were going to get a better deal than enlisted men, and there was kind of a back and forth what would be best. This is the most equitable process that we've had so far. A stated fund of $1,500 for your 20 years, $30,000. A retired colonel or a general makes obviously a lot more with their retirement. However, everyone's kind of on an equal standing there. Another actual interesting statement is that with the downsides in the United States military, I believe it's 40,000 officers are going to be losing their jobs. My son-in-law's a Marine fighter pilot, and he's in the Marine Corps, and they just got papers here this week that they're going to be rifting a lot of majors. The core of middle management in the military, Army, Navy, Air Force, the same way. And that's not including the number of enlisted that are going to be coming back. This is an opportunity for us to get highly trained individuals who want to come back here. Ralph came back here because his wife wanted to. And that's the way it goes. My daughter and my son-in-law is going to stay in the reserves, but he's getting out after 12 years, and they're coming back here because not because of any encumbrances of finances, because he's not a retired individual. However, this does give a leg up on us getting back our more and more of these men and women who are going to be leaving the military, and quite frankly, we need them to grow Minnesota, to build the revenues that we need to take care of all the projects that the governor just signed that he wants to do. It's just an equitable way to do it. The timing is right, and I believe this is what needs to be done to make Minnesota more veteran-friendly. The President of the United States, the governor, the House of Representatives, and the State Senate, they all talk about making Minnesota more veteran-friendly. I have friends of mine that live in Hudson, retired. They live in Osceola. They live in Hudson, and they live in Prescott. They live there and work in Minnesota because they know that Minnesota's not, Wisconsin's not going to tax them. And that's my statement. I'm sticking to it.
And Mr. Chair, some of you might be wondering what other states are doing. I got this document from House Research, Nina Manzi, and this was dated in March 31st, 2014. And of the 50 states, we take a look at a table. Of the 50 states of District Columbia, 9 do not have general income tax. Okay, there's 9 states that just don't have income tax. Of the 42 remaining states, 35 exempt at least a portion of the military retirement income, and 3 provide credits for retirement and income, and 2 of the 3 states that provide credits also allow limited exemption. This leaves 6 states that do not exempt any portion of the military retirement income since the tax year 2009. Now, it's really 5 because Minnesota just got rid of that, or excuse me, Iowa just got rid of this tax last year. 14 states fully exclude military retirement income from a taxable income. That means the total military retirement income is excluded from is fully excluded. 18 states exclude a fixed amount of military retirement income, which this piece of legislation will request. 3 states including Minnesota exclude some pension income including military retirement income subject to income or age limitations. That's what this bill will get rid of. But I know we have Mr. Purcell, Representative Purcell has an amendment that addresses that issue, and we'll bring that up. But 3 states, including Minnesota, allow a credit against tax liability for retirement income. Minnesota's credit is limited to military retirement income, while others 2 states allow credit of all retirement income. All 3 states subject to the credits to income-based phase-outs. Minnesota's credit will phase out at a rate of 10% and adjusted gross income in excess of $30,000. So if your adjusted gross income is $30,000 in Minnesota, it's phased out. You don't qualify. And when it gets to $37,500 or higher, you just don't qualify for this benefit of where you can subtract $750 when you do your taxes. So with that, we see what other states are doing, and we hope that now's the time to maybe do something here in Minnesota. And Mr. Chair, I'd like to address Representative Purcell's amendment.
Chair recognizes Representative Purcell. You wanted to speak to this issue?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just quickly,
Mr. Chair, it'd be the 137A2 amendment.
And I had one question before that, if I may. You mentioned, Representative Detmer, that we had this on the floor last biennium. Do you recall what the fiscal note was at that time? I know you and I talked about a couple different variations on this, and I had supported for all veterans to have their military service recognized, and that was too big of a fiscal note, as I recall. But
I'm digging through my
papers.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Purcell, dated March 28, 2014, the individual income tax, the revenue note, the first year was zero. Then 2015 would have been 18.2. Fiscal year 2016 would be 18.7, and fiscal year 2017 would be 19.2. That was the fiscal note at that time.
Representative Purcell.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And we will get the new note here soon, Representative Detmer. We can expect to see that.
Right.
Yeah. And if I,
Representative Purcell,
would take the A2 amendment, I'd like to move adoption to A2.
Purcell moves Amendment A2, and to that, Mr. Purcell.
And thank you. And I'm going to speak briefly, but I'm going to ask for Mr. Gelman to help me out here, because this gets into some areas that, quite honestly, I know we're just ensuring that we have the good that we're trying to do doesn't get obscured in a couple of other areas of law that we have existing. And if I could, Mr. Chair, ask Mr. Gelman to help walk through this amendment.
Very good. Mr. Gelman, would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gelman. I'm the caucus researcher for the DFL caucus. What the A2 amendment does is simply make the Representative Detmer's bill an either-or situation. Instead of repealing the existing credit that is available for military retirees who have gross adjusted income under $37,500, between $30,000 and $37,500, there's a phase out. It provides a credit in current taxes for that income. The bill, as drafted, repeals that credit and replaces it with an income tax deduction, a subtraction from federal adjusted gross income. As written, House File 137 probably doesn't affect anyone. In other words, the subtraction from income is probably greater benefit than the existing credit. However, if the subtraction from income is reduced as this process moves forward from what is currently written into House File 137, there may be a situation where a person will actually lose benefit because of the repeal of the credit that's current law. So what the A2 amendment does is basically say you can take either the credit that's in current law or the subtraction from income that's in 137, whichever has a better benefit for you.
Thank you, Representative Purcell.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Gelman. And I believe there's before go ahead here, I see another question here. So
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just more of a parliamentary inquiry. I don't have the 137A2 amendment, but I do have a 137A1 amendment with no author on it. So I'm just kind of wondering what we're looking at. If the 137A is not being offered, or who the author of that was.
Representative O'Driscoll, it's my understanding that the A1 amendment is not being offered at this time. So we proceeded with the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I might, staff has also provided me with a copy of the A2 amendment. Thank you.
Representative Purcell, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just any other questions, I'll probably defer to Mr. Gelman, would just renew my motion for the amendment.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. I'll take this as a friendly amendment, and I think this is good. I'm glad that this point was brought up, because I think we're probably talking to somebody a little very low income, maybe handicapped and so forth. Yeah, this would be a good amendment, and I take it as a friendly amendment.
Okay. To the A2 amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same. Amendment is passed. Mr. Detmer, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, if there's no other questions of me, I see Representative Lesh has a question.
Yes, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Detmer, what percentage of veterans are we talking about here that this will benefit? I mean, how many, you know, you need to reach 20 years or get, medically retired to qualify for this. What percentage of veterans does that include?
Okay.
Representative Detmer?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh. Good question, because right now there's approximately 370,000 veterans that live in Minnesota, but only 4.7% or somewhere between 18 to 19,000 are actually retired here in Minnesota. So this is not only for those that are here, but also to draw veterans into the state of Minnesota, too, that are looking to come back to Minnesota or find a job here and so forth. So about 4.7% of our veterans in Minnesota are actually retired. And remember, that doesn't mean they're all drawing retirement. As was pointed out by one of our guest speakers here, testifiers, is that as a reservist, which you are, a National Guard, you don't draw any retirement until age 60. So that's approximately...
Representative Lesh.
If I could, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Deborah, I realize there's there's speculation. Mr. Dene had cited the numbers from Wisconsin. I don't know how much of that increased economic output can be directly attributable to veterans or not. I'm sure it's open for discussion, but aside from that, aside from the build it and they'll come model, of those who are here, and maybe I'm not understanding this 4.7%, but what percentage of our veterans will be eligible? What percentage have reached their 20 years and could ultimately benefit from this this bill of all of our veterans? Do you know?
Representative Detmer?
I guess I don't. All I know is was the 4.7% that are actually here in the state right now that are retired here, and if they're drawing a retirement, they're eligible. Okay, not until they start drawing the retirement.
Right.
Okay. That would be my answer. And I just feel that hey, we're a better state than Wisconsin, and I think we can. We can outdo the states around us and Iowa, North Dakota, South Dakota that surround us that are providing this this benefit for their veterans.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh.
I've done a cursory research on this, but I recall the last time I did the research was for my company commander down at Fort Benning when they were talking about slashing benefits for folks. I think that was in 2011. And some folks were pretty upset because that was the whole reason why they stuck around this long in the first place, is to get the retirement benefit, and they were talking about slashing it. So he said, Lesh, you're the lawyer in the battalion. Go research this. So I did. There are going to be, I think, a lot of folks who don't benefit from this, and I think the logical rebuttal would be, well, Lesh, we can't do anything about the federal system because it's the feds who decide you got to get to 20 years, and I understand that, but I just think that should be taken into consideration.
from that research I did back 4 years ago, I think I recall that it was only 20% of veterans who were actually going to get to their 20 years and reach the benefit. Now, those are national numbers, right? So the 4.7% is much lower in Minnesota. That might be part of your argument that, well, maybe we'll get closer to 20% if we have the benefit. You know, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if those numbers are still accurate. But I just think that that's something to be should be taken into consideration, that the benefit is only available to a small percentage of folks who actually have served. And, you know, again, that's a federal decision. But we are making a state decision that dovetails off that and further enables the system. So.
Representative Dedmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And in your packet, you also have a letter that I received from Mr. Jerry Weinstein, who's a Master Sergeant, United States Air Force, retired, and works under United Healthcare. And he stated to me in a letter, he says, as the author of House File 137, I thought it would be interest to you. I'm forwarding you a copy of the American Military Society Weekly Newsletter. The second article shows a study done by the state of Maryland concerning tax relief for the military retirement pay. I can certainly vouch for this on a small scale because we encountered this when we relocated our United Health Group personnel from San Antonio, Texas, who does not have income tax, to Minnesota. The issue was a major contributor to many of the people involved to decline the move here. So it can be an assistance on this issue. Please feel free to contact me. And I've included that in your packet, also a for immediate release, what the state of Maryland is doing right now. Of course, Maryland has a lot of military personnel in Maryland, but a lot of people maybe work there but maybe not live there. So they're in the process of looking at the same thing. I don't know how they're going to do it, but there's a website you can go to and check on, see what Maryland is doing on the same issue. So, and with that, if there's no other questions, we've got some questions.
Representative Luke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. I saw your Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dettmer, there are a couple of things that I think about with this, maybe ancillary to what Representative Lesh was talking about, and that's preparing our young people for retirement and having them think about retirement. So are there, my family all meet the 20-year situation, so I really haven't had much opportunity to work with young people in the military who aren't going to be there for the full 20 years. What does the military do to help people plan for retirement other than if you stay for 20 years, you've got this? Is there something in between? And then a second parallel question perhaps is just I don't know whether there would be some way or some purpose in linking this as you're trying to make Minnesota more attractive to military retirees. You know, there's a great deal of conversation now about changing some of the academic requirements so that people who have skills in the military, you're talking about having them come back and be valuable employees, but are we also then at the same time giving them credit for what they have learned in the military? Just, do you see where I'm going with that?
Mr. Chair,
thank you.
Representative,
those are some good questions, and I know in our MAG Military Action Group meeting, we discussed a lot of these issues, and there's a lot of good things that are going on with DEED and Department of Transportation and the Viking Stadium that's going up and all the different things, the skill sets that you learn in the military, many of them do apply to civilian jobs. And in terms of retirement, planning for retirement, I know a lot of people enter the service today, they want those educational benefits, they want to, you know, be able to help themselves get through college. Many might serve for maybe a 6-year enlistment, and then, you know, for those benefits. And other people say, well, I've learned these skills, I want to stay and serve.
and I want to stay and go for that 20 years. And some go, like Representative Newton, was it 38 years? 23 years. I know people that have served 35, 36, 37 years, and myself 25 years. So there's just a lot of different reasons and why people serve so many years, and some of them all of a sudden they get into a leadership in the military and they enjoy that. They lead troops and so forth, or they're head of a certain piece of equipment that they like working with, and so there's a lot of different reasons, but they're all probably good reasons. And there's reasons why people leave also. If that answers your question, are there any other questions?
Representative Ward? Representative Lewitt?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a little bit of personal experience with this. I retired in 1997 after 28 years of service in the Navy, and I'll tell you right up front, they send you to school to retire, at least in the Navy. I would assume they do it in the other services. And it's a several-day school, and they lay it out rhyme and verse, the tax treatment you'll receive from all 50 states. And they rank them, stack them. They want to know what your plan is, and they advise you specifically. There's a difference between Minnesota, Wisconsin, North, South Dakota. Obviously, I had indicated I was going to come back here. So make no mistake, at least in the Navy, we're ranked every time somebody reaches retirement age, and it's laid out as to how you compare to other states. From the standpoint of the percentage of retired military personnel or personnel that have fulfilled the reserve requirement but are not yet 60, doesn't surprise me that it's a very, very low number, about 4.7% of all the veterans in Minnesota, because you make those kind of decisions. When you decide to make that big of a career change, you have to count every penny. You don't always have a guaranteed job waiting out there. In most cases, you do. But that's a huge career change, and you get down to looking very specifically at the tax benefits. The third point, those 20 or 30 years, whatever years of experience and skill set that come back, they typically don't just bring back that service member's skill set. They typically bring back a bride that may very well have another set of skill sets that are very, very complementary here to Minnesota. I brought back my bride, who's a registered nurse trained at the Northwestern Abbott here many years ago. So this makes sense. And one last thing, to kind of get at that, leveling it and making it kind of straightforward and fair. In my case, I retired as a commander in the Navy, upper middle grade senior management. I really support this of putting a leveler in there, so that in Minnesota we're treating everybody that would qualify for this in the same manner, and we're not going to reward, we've got some generals and such that are retired here in Minnesota, some quite famous ones. They're not going to get a big break out of this if it goes forward. There's a good level that I think is fair in there, and I would certainly support this. And, it's got a long ways to go, but for those young people, when I say young, I'm talking about somebody with 20 years service and, not quite 50 yet. It'll cause them to take another look at Minnesota, and at least we won't be on the bottom of the list, 5 states. That's pretty disappointing that would treat our folks that way. So I really do support this. Thank you, sir.
Is there any public testimony to this bill? Yes, would you come down and state your name for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Thomas Johnson. I live in Eden Prairie.
Go ahead, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. One of my daughters attended ROTC at UMD, and she is now an officer in the Air Force and just made the captain's list. She'll be promoted to captain. My other daughter married a young man who just made captain's list. They're stationed in Texas. And I wanted to speak to this issue because I heard today about how retirees are talking about the best states to retire in, that when you're getting ready to retire. Well, both of my daughter and my son-in-law, stationed in two different parts of the country, are discussing this now. So if this were to pass today, it would still take several years in order for that word to get out that Minnesota is no longer, excuse the term, a hostile place to retire, because they're talking about this still while they're junior officers. So I think it's important, because not only are my son-in-law and my his wife and my other daughter not planning on retiring back in Minnesota, but my wife is saying that when they retire and they retire elsewhere, we'll be moving from Minnesota to be closer with to our grandchildren. So it's not only the net loss of two retired military retirees not coming here, it may be an issue of more Minnesotans moving out of state to be closer to where their grandkids and their families are in other states. And thank you for...
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. We have about 5 minutes left. Is there anyone else that... yes, would you come forward and state your name for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Lori Allness. I want to say that as I sit here today and give my testimony in support of House File 137, my situation represents many fellow veterans who are in the same position regarding military retirement pay. My husband and I are both military retirees. My husband, Colonel Eric Allness, served 28 years in the National Guard, while I served 25 years in the Reserves and in the National Guard. Both of us will receive a pension when we turn 60. For me, that's in 4 years, so I'm catching up to you, Representative. Okay. We're so fortunate that we're going to be blessed with an additional income as we reach our senior years, but they are modest income, modest pensions. And so we have to think twice and have serious discussions about whether we're going to stay in Minnesota, because they're going to be taxed. I'm asking for your support for House File 137, because it will have an extremely beneficial trickle-down effect for Minnesota. And that's because there are two types, as it's been said, two types of retirees. First of all, there's those people retiring from active duty who do so after 20 years, and they receive their pension immediately. That means the majority of these retirees are around 40 years old. These folks start new careers. They are experienced, and they usually land good jobs, and that means their money is going to be spent here. They pay taxes, they buy homes, everything that's been said already. And their new income stays right here in Minnesota. The second category of those retiring is someone like myself. They retire from the National Guard or the Reserves. They too can retire after 20 years, but I will not, and they will not receive their pension until they are 60. These folks have had civilian jobs here. That means when they retire, they're going to receive two pensions, from their civilian job and from the military. Again, their income, their retirement income, will benefit Minnesota. If they remain, they are contributing to Minnesota revenue. But the reality is that many military veterans, both from active duty and from the reserves, leave Minnesota because it is one of only, like you said, Representative, five states that still fully taxes the pension. Military retirees like me and my husband were empty nesters, having no obligation to stay in Minnesota, as this gentleman mentioned. We've had to say goodbye to a lot of our military friends because they've made the decision to move out of state, looking for those more friendly states. And
Ms. Holmes, would you please finish shortly?
Yes. And I just want to say again, military pension is a modest amount, and a lot of military people continue to work, and they will benefit. And so I thank you for your time and your support.
Thank you. Seeing no further witnesses, we renew the motion. We do have one more. Yes, sir. Would you come forward, state your name, and give us a brief testimony? Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Please hold it to 1 minute, if you would.
Okay, I'll try it. My name is Chuck Jones, and I am presently the Department of Minnesota Commander for the Military Order of the Purple Heart. I don't get a military retirement thing, but I'll tell you what, there's quite a few people that do. And currently, right now, I have a member in my organization that's out on the road checking out these other states and whatnot for their taxes, because this man did 20-plus years in the Navy, and then he just retired recently, in the last 2 years, from the VA hospital. And his retirement pay is affected because of not of being taxed. And he has three daughters, and they also have children. And the money that you're getting, the state of Minnesota will be gaining from those people is minimal, you know, compared to what will be going out of state, especially with this Red Bull crew, because the state of Minnesota has a lot of members that are probably looking at this stuff that when I got back from Vietnam, we were just happy to get out of the military. And I know myself that anything that you members on here can do for veterans is a plus in your hat, because you're going to gain a lot more people in this state here from other taxes, because let's face it, Minnesota is a taxing state. So I highly recommend that this here thing by Mr. Detmer, and if you guys can put a feather in your hat and do whatever you can for veterans, do it. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for your testimony and your service, sir. With that, we renew to move House File 137 as amended to taxes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same. Passed, and with that, we are adjourned.